closing it out with Sweeping Promises right there. The song's called Good Living Is Coming For You, title track off their album that came out last year. We heard Spread Joy with a song called Unoriginal. Ribbon Stage before that with Stone Heart Blue. We heard Karen Marks in that set, Delta 5. A new single from Hines called Coffee. Kate Fagan, Blondie, Algebra Suicide, Angeline. Angeline's getting a fresh reissue coming up soon. Her album Driven to Fantasy, song's called Tangerine Rose. That is Angeline, LA royalty. I forgot to give a big thank you to all the volunteers who were here today, already mailing out some marathon swag. I saw someone on our comments board said they got one of my TJ premiums in the mail today. If you haven't gotten yours yet, don't worry, it's coming. Takes us some time, and it's just us humans doing it all. So thanks to Emily, Alisa, John, and Neil for helping out today for the love of WFMU. If you want to help out, volunteer, help us mail out swag, hang out with us for the day, contact volunteer director Scott, scott@wfmu.org. It is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, 91.9 FM and online, WFMU.org. This is Radio Ravioli with me, Olivia, here every Monday, and I'll be here next week too. So, see you later. Have a great week. Fingers crossed the weather stays okay.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation, live from Jersey City in that great state of New Jersey. It's great to be here. And I appreciate you spending some time with me this evening or afternoon or sometime in the future, whenever you're listening. I appreciate you spending your time listening to this show. And I am confident that it's going to be worth your while this next hour because I'm really excited about this interview that I'm going to play for you this evening. Richard Polt is going to be on the show talking about his book, The Typewriter Revolution, A Typist's Companion for the 21st Century. Now, you should know about Richard Polt, and you're going to learn in the interview. He's sort of a name in the world of typewriter aficionados. If you saw that documentary a few years ago called California Typewriter, that was the one that had Tom Hanks in it. Richard Polt is also featured in that documentary. And he's going to describe in this interview, among other things, why typewriters are still important and always will be better than computers at some things. Not at everything. We're gonna get into the details. If you would like to join the live listener chat during the show, go to WFMU.org and click playlist and comments, and you can join the listeners who are chatting away right now. If you're listening in the future to an archive or podcast version of the show, you can go to tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And find the playlist link for the April 15, 2024 show. And you can read those comments that transpired this evening. But also on the playlist are links to Richard's book, his blog, his recent blog post from last fall that I may talk about after the interview that has a mention of Tectonic in it. There's just a lot of really good resources. But first, why don't we go ahead and listen to this interview with Richard Polt, who is going to get you excited about typewriters, as he got me excited about typewriters. Although there's a hitch, which you're going to learn in the interview, why my excitement I'm slightly hedging my excitement for a very specific reason, which we will get into. Anyway, let's go ahead and listen to my interview with Richard Polt here on Tectonic on WFMU. Richard Polt, welcome to Tectonic.
It's good to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show, Richard. I really enjoyed reading your book, The Typewriter Revolution, A Typist's Companion for the 21st Century. Now, this book came out in 2015, and I usually cover more recently published books on this show, but this book, The Typewriter Revolution, is still totally pertinent to the situation we're in right now with digital technology. In fact, 9 years on, it might even be more relevant than it was in some ways in 2015. So we're going to get into the themes of typewriters and why they're still so important. You are a philosophy professor at Xavier University in Cincinnati, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And in addition to writing The Typewriter Revolution, you are, I think it's fair to say, an avid collector of typewriters. I noticed in the book, which again, this is as of 9 years ago, you wrote that at last count, I owned 287 typewriters. So Richard, can you bring us up to date? What's the typewriter count these days?
It's actually down to 175 because I've heard too many stories about collectors who die and then leave their heirs with tons and tons of unwanted, you know, heavy metals. So I'm trying to get down to the point where, you know, I'll be down to like one typewriter right around the time my life expectancy is up.
Okay, so you're at 100 and change. Can you name your favorite typewriter or your favorite couple. I mean, are you actually using these typewriters or are they mostly there as a collection?
Oh, I use them. That's important. Now, the people listening to this can't see, but I'm showing you on Zoom my first and sentimental favorite typewriter. It's a 1937 Remington Noiseless number 7. It was my first one. My dad got it for me at a yard sale circa 1977. And yes, I use it. I'm currently working on a manuscript that that I use that typewriter for. So it has really kind of empowered me and excited me to start using the typewriters in my collection, which is kind of what led to the book, because it felt like a sort of revolutionary act.
This Remington Noiseless is the subject of the dedication of the book, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you actually use these typewriters, and in The Typewriter Revolution, you write in depth about why people should be using typewriters, the various moments in their lives and work to reach for a typewriter, the reasons they should reach for a typewriter. And I'll just say at the outset, this book is, and you say it yourself in the book, this book is not anti-digital technology. You're not telling people to not use digital tools. It's instead a very positive book saying, let's not forget about this great tool we have that can do some things that digital technology can't do. One of the uses that you write about, I want to use an example from your blog because you write this blog and keep it well maintained. I'm going to link to it on the playlist for listeners to take a look. But a few months ago, you wrote a post about a mutual friend of ours, Ed Park, who is a novelist. He's been on Tectonic a number of times and recently wrote a novel called Same Bed, Different Dreams. And the reason you wrote about Ed Park on your typewriter blog is because Ed Park wrote drafts and brainstorms for Same Bed, Different Dreams as part of the writing process. Can you say a little bit about why writers still to this day like to type on typewriters at different moments?
Sure. Let me, before I say that, though, I'm going to be even more modest than you made me out to be. So I'm not saying get rid of all computers. And I'm not saying that people in general should all reach for a typewriter, because it is a very individual thing. And I like to say that, good, solid 1% of Americans could benefit from having a typewriter in their lives. But that's still, over 3 million people. So we have a lot of room for growth. As far as brainstorming goes, what I like is the fact that you cannot easily delete on a typewriter, which sounds like a disadvantage, and in many cases it is. But if you just want to keep on writing and you don't want to be second guessing yourself as you can on the computer and saying, oh, well, let me, fiddle with that and change those words and look up a synonym, and pretty soon you're off down some rabbit hole. Just keep going. It's sort of like improv, where the rule is yes and, right? So you put something down, it's stupid, yeah, but you say yes, and you don't call it stupid, you don't exit out, you say yes to it and keep on going. So I have done a lot of brainstorming like that for philosophy, and I've also done NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, a couple of times, and wrote it all by typewriter. And since then, I've revised that novel a lot, but just to pump something out, it was great.
You start this book with something you call the Typewriter Manifesto, which sets the stage for the whole argument throughout this book. It's a great brief explanation of why typewriters are still so important. I just want to read the very beginning of this Typewriter Manifesto. We assert our right to resist the paradigm, to rebel against the information regime, to escape the data stream. What are you saying there?
Well, that came to me on a glorious day in the gym in 2012, when I was feeling just sort of rebellious. Why does everybody have to go along with the latest technical developments, and why can't I proudly use my typewriters? And the paradigm is not just the sheer existence of computers and digital technology, but the idea that that's always the best way to do things, and that we have to jump when the software and hardware manufacturers tell us to jump. If you don't do that, you're a Luddite. And I do know your episode on Luddites, which was eye-opening, and we should be proud to be Luddites. the information regime, it's what I just said, the idea that everything, that IT should determine everything, that progress basically consists in the greater harvesting and managing of information. And if you take it too far, as some people do in theory or practice, it means that information is really all there is, that being, that reality reduces to information. And escape the data stream, you know, 10 years ago, it was already huge. And now it's, I don't know, 10,000 times bigger and exponentially growing. And everything we do generates information. And it's, as you have shown on your show, it gets sucked up voluntarily or involuntarily. We provide it to people. So it's just great to find a little island in the stream or a little place where you're doing something that can't be swept up into that.
Yeah, so many of the aspects of digital technology that I rail against and my guests rail against are just not present in the experience of using a typewriter. You write about this. Again, back in 2015, you were already pointing this out to us. For example, when you're on a typewriter, you don't have the constant distractions of little pop-ups coming up and, you know, the immediate availability of other apps and other websites that you may want to check. It really opens you up to a state of focus and really a state of flow if you get really good at it, where the words are just flowing to the typewriter. There's also absolutely no surveillance on a typewriter. Zero surveillance. And I wonder if people can even remember what that was like to use tools that didn't have surveillance and distractions built in.
Yeah, I think you're right. We're so used, either consciously or unconsciously, we're using these tools where we're being watched or we can be watched, our data can be harvested, and there are always these, you know, super accessible sidelines. And I'm as bad as anybody about going down those rabbit holes when I'm on my laptop or my phone. And, you know, I have a problem with this technology too. I'm not superior. But that's why I and all of us maybe need some moments when, as you say, we can focus and actually experience real privacy, which has become a luxury.
Now, we're talking about you writing in 2015 about these differences between typewriters and digital tools. But in the book, you quote someone who wrote even earlier along these lines. It was Wendell Berry, who I have quoted on a number of occasions on this show. Back in 1987, Wendell Berry wrote an essay called "Why I Am Not Going to Buy a Computer." And in this essay, he sings the praises of typewriters. And in fact, he gives a numbered list of what he calls my standards for technological innovation. So basically, he's describing what good tools have to be for him to choose to use them. Number one, the new tool should be cheaper than the one it replaces. Try that for your next iPhone or other surveillance device. Number two, it should be at least as small in scale as the one it replaces. Try to do that with the surveillance devices that seem to be getting bigger and bigger in each generation. Number three, it should do work that is clearly and demonstrably better than the one it replaces. And I'm not going to read all of them, but he goes on to list all of these aspects that typewriters fulfill and digital devices and surveillance devices do not. And he points out along the way that his wife, as of 1987, was typing on a Royal Standard typewriter, bought new in 1956, and was still working fine over 30 years later. And that's something that comes through in this book, that typewriters last. There's no need to be on an upgrade path.
Yeah, they're incredibly durable. So just this afternoon, before speaking to you, I met a colleague here who was looking for a home for her husband's old high school typewriter, electric Smith Corona, and then her mother-in-law's big Smith Corona, which was made in the 30s, refurbished in the 50s, and survives into the 2020s. And I tried it, and it feels great. It feels snappy and just purrs along. And these things were made beautifully. And, you know, what do we own that was made before we were born and will survive with just a little luck after we die, and that we can use for our whole lifetime. That's extraordinary. And there's something very special about that.
Something else that survives a long time is the paper that goes through a typewriter, as opposed to these ethereal bits that we type in social media posts and emails. Maybe they get backed up somewhere, maybe not. Maybe the format that the data is in is readable in 10 years, maybe not. Who knows? But as you point out, good paper stock, typewritten, can last hundreds of years, well beyond our lifetimes.
Yeah, the digital data is, of course, so easily copied and altered, and that has its advantages. But yeah, if you want something that's durable and just sort of feels real, put it on paper.
Okay, here's another aspect of typewriters that I thought you wrote very nicely about. You write, a computer gets packed with data, but it's just a disposable vehicle. A typewriter remembers nothing that you type on it, but your personality rubs off on it. So you have a reflection about using certain typewriters and how they become something that the human actually forms a relationship with, which is not really what you do with your surveillance phone.
Yeah, it's almost, I don't know, symbiotic. I mean, you get to know the particular feel of your tool and particular quirks. And especially, you know, after 70 or 80 years, these things have developed some quirks. But you work around them because you're getting to know your typewriter, and you're willing to invest that time in them. And then a person's habits leave usually subtle but real traces in, you know, irregularities in the machine and so on. And this can become a very mystical thing. So people get very excited about a typewriter that was used by Hemingway or something, as if his soul is still in it. But nobody will feel that somebody's soul is in their laptop, right? A lot of data about them is in there, but somehow the personal magic doesn't seem to be there.
Ironically, the billionaires in Silicon Valley want to upload their souls into their laptops.
Yeah, a hideous and futile endeavor.
I like that. Hideous and futile. That'd be a great tagline for most of Silicon Valley these days.
Right. A, it's not going to work. And B, if it did, it would be a horrible nightmare. So.
Right. And so they say, really? Let's invest more in it.
Right.
I did a whole episode a couple of years ago on the Torment Nexus. Have you heard about this meme?
Yes, I've heard that episode. It's hilarious.
I also want to bring up that there was a documentary film that you appeared in called California Typewriter. This was from 2016. I watched it, and much like your book, listeners should not dismiss this because it's from several years ago. It's still totally relevant. It dives into the world of what you call the typosphere. Collectors of typewriters, aficionados of typewriters, and it focuses on one repair shop, which is now closed in Berkeley, California, but which at the time was still hanging on, called California Typewriter. One of the things that someone said is that there are no factories turning out high-quality typewriters. I think there are some low-quality typewriters out there in China or elsewhere, but no one is making really good typewriters anymore. And so I'm watching this documentary, and I'm seeing people like Tom Hanks, who has, I don't know, 200 typewriters or something, and you have over 100. These people who are so passionate about their collections and using typewriters, and you think, no one is making any new ones. And so what does the future hold for this tool that you have written the praises of if there's no more supply of these things?
Yeah, that's a good question, but it's not an urgent problem because, you know, they were made by the millions. I think probably most of them were not thrown out. They ended up in basements or attics or something because people felt, oh, this is important somehow, or this is valuable. I'm not going to just toss it. So the supply still exceeds demand. As you can see, just go to eBay, search for typewriter, and tens of thousands of the things turn up. And a lot of them are from the mid-20th century, sort of the golden moment of high-quality typewriters. And with a little knowledge, a little effort, you can get one to work. I do have a dream that someday there's going to be a new top quality manual typewriter. There's one factory I know of in the world, in the Shanghai area, that is making manual typewriters today, which is kind of neat. They're portables, and I've had a few of them in my day, but the quality control is so bad, and it maybe needs to be in order to get them down to selling retail for $200 or something. It's so bad that I would never recommend that. So look for a 1950s Olympia or Smith Corona, and you'll be much happier. And I should add that that film, California Typewriter, directed by Doug Nickel, is genius. I mean, it's brought a lot of people to this hobby and or this pursuit or this revolution, whatever you want to call it.
Watching the documentary and reading your book, Richard, both reminded me of my own history with typewriters because I learned how to type. I taught myself how to type on a manual typewriter when I was probably, I must have been 8 or 9 years old. And I remember getting the typing instruction book that says, type the following, L L L L L F F F F F, and working my way through that book. I was so excited to be able to use this. I was taking piano lessons at the time, and I liked that idea of becoming somewhat proficient in both the piano and the typewriter. And then a few years later, my family bought an electric typewriter, and that was so exciting because with a lot less effort, I could type the same letters. I don't know. It doesn't sound like such a big upgrade when we think about our devices these days, but it was a big deal back then. And I think the manual typewriter was a Smith Corona. I was looking through, you have a couple of chapters where you have these beautiful photographs of different brands of old typewriters that have been refurbished. And my guess is that it was a Smith Corona. That was a common type in the US, right?
Yeah, definitely. They were the most successful manufacturer of U.S. portable typewriters. The other big American makes were Remington and Royal. Then there were a few imports, a few competing minor makes. But yeah, a lot of us have of a certain age. Those of us who straddle the pre-personal computer and post-personal computer moment, we have those memories. And for me too, I was also learning the piano, and it is a sort of actually an early there was an early typewriter invention that was referred to as the literary piano. It is like a musical instrument. It has some of that same magic where there's it's a very finite object, finite set of keys, but it has infinite potential.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Richard Polt, a philosophy professor at Xavier University in Cincinnati, typewriter collector, blogger, and author of the book The Typewriter Revolution, a typist's companion for the 21st century. We're talking about typewriters, what they're still good for, even in this age of powerful digital surveillance devices, why they will always be superior to digital devices in some respects, and as Richard just said before the break, why they have, in some ways, infinite potential. If you're interested to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org, click playlist and comments, and you can join the listeners there. We're having a good conversation, and if I have some time, I'll read some of the comments afterward. For now, let's go back to my interview with Richard Polt here on Tectonic on WFMU. Now, I want to bring up something that is probably my only pushback to you, Richard, in this entire book. Because my history with typing proceeded beyond that electric typewriter. Of course, computers came. I studied computer science in college. I did a lot of typing on various keyboards in college. And then my career has always been in technology. I have been typing on computers for I don't know how many decades now. But When I was in my 20s, early in my career, I found that my wrists really began to hurt. And I did not want to get RSI, repetitive stress injury, because you need a brace. Sometimes people need surgery. It's bad. And so I did some reading. This is very early days on the internet. And I found a forum where people said, what you need to do is you need to switch your key map. Because QWERTY, the arrangement of keys on the standard keyboard, QWERTY is the standard key map on keyboards all around the world. QWERTY apparently was developed to prevent people from typing so fast that they jammed the rods. And there is a different key map called Dvorak, which opens up the keys in a way that allows people to type faster. Anyway, I switched cold turkey when I was in my 20s, and I was proficient as a QWERTY typist, but I switched overnight to Dvorak, and my wrist pain went away, and it has never come back. And over the years, I've had a couple of acquaintances or coworkers or friends who've complained about wrist pain, and I've said, here's what worked for me. And a couple of them actually have switched to Dvorak, and they experienced the cure as well. So I noticed this is a long way to lead up to say, you did mention Dvorak once or twice in the typewriter revolution, but I am looking at these beautiful typewriters in the book, and they all have the QWERTY key map. And I think, I can't go back to QWERTY. So, what would you recommend that I do, Richard?
Well, I'm impressed that you were able to switch your reflexes so efficiently. That's great. I've never really tried to learn Dvorak myself, but I have nothing against it. That's not, of course, a typewriter versus computer issue. That's a keyboard layout issue. And the Dvorak keyboard, I think it was developed in the 30s by Dr. August Dvorak. So, of course, typewriters were made with the Dvorak layout, and you run across them once in a while. So my recommendation is post a want on eBay, Dvorak typewriter, and one will pop up sooner or later.
One of the main technologies that we use in the digital age is the layout of the keys on our keyboard. Now, interestingly enough, I think when people use thumbs on a surveillance phone, that's different. I use QWERTY just fine there. That doesn't hurt my wrists, because it's just thumbs.
I've never been able to type with my thumbs, but I really liked it when Apple introduced this. I forget what you call it, but you don't have to lift your finger. You can just move it around in a little dance over the flat keyboard. That helps me type much faster, although I'd still much rather, of course, be using a typewriter.
Of course. And I should say, you also use your typewriter when you are preparing your blog posts. Your blog, which is called The Typewriter Revolution, just like your book, has posts that are mostly images of your typing from your typewriter.
Yeah, we call this typecasting. And it's fun. Again, this stuff is not for everybody, but you might want to give it a try. I think partly it conveys care. It conveys that you took the time to actually create a physical thing and then take a picture or scan it and upload it, which is, of course, more bothersome than typing directly into your blog. But it sends a message. Just the way you created it sends a good message. Plus, then I have a physical record of my blog. I keep these typecasts in a little album, and long after, Blogspot no longer exists, the paper will continue.
Yeah, that's a great way to maintain an ongoing backup of your blog writing. Very few bloggers could say that they have a physical representation of their posts. Some of them have an external hard drive, but again, who knows if that'll be readable in a few years.
Yeah, it seems like too much trouble. And I'm guilty of some of the same things with photos. You've talked about this on your show. We should all be printing out our best photos and making beautiful little books, which you can do. You can order online. But I have to say, I'm not keeping up with that.
One of the uses of the typewriter that you write about is letter writing. And this came up in the documentary as well.
this was probably the best pitch for me that I encountered in the book and the film, because I like to write letters and thank you notes now and then. And I thought, how great would it be if I could start writing letters on a typewriter? Can you talk about what's so special about writing and receiving a typewritten letter?
I'm not sure it's very different from writing and receiving a handwritten letter. And I have nothing against handwriting. I love doing that too. But receiving something on paper, again, just even before you read it, it means something, right? Because here's somebody who took the trouble to actually put ink on paper through some sort of non-digital method and then put it in this thing called an envelope and addressed it and spent whatever it costs now, 68 cents or whatever, to mail this thing to you, you know, may have licked the envelope and put part of their DNA onto that message. And then it's been physically delivered. This is so retro and also so thoughtful, you know, even if it's just a little cliched note, it's very much appreciated. So part of being part of the typosphere and being somewhat well-known in this community is that I do get typewritten letters, usually one or two a week, from various countries, various friends. Some of these people I know only through the letters, and I try to respond promptly when I can. But you don't have to right away. That's a good thing. So an email, if you don't answer it within 24 hours, you're a jerk, right? If you take a month to answer a letter, that's okay. Your correspondent is generally going to understand. That's fine. And it gives you a little more time to compose your thoughts. And you'll tend to write more than in an email or text, because you want to fill up a page at least, right? And as you, just the sheer act of wanting to write more means that probably something more complicated and possibly deeper is going to come out. And then there's the surveillance issue, right? So, of course, no listener to the show would write an email which says something personally sensitive. But in a letter, assuming you trust the person who's getting it, you can pour your heart out.
Yeah, for listeners who wonder, there's, at least so far, there's no surveillance of the interior contents of an envelope yet. There is surveillance of the metadata, and that is the surface of the envelope showing the to and from addresses are surveilled, and they're scanned and captured by the U.S. Postal Service. Every single piece of mail is surveilled in that way. So it's interesting. Postal mail is a combination of guaranteed surveillance by the government and no surveillance for the interior. But the important part, as you said, is what's on the inside. That makes me fantasize about getting a typewriter again someday, going back to my childhood roots and tapping something out on a manual. If somebody wanted to, I'm just asking for a friend, Richard, if somebody wanted to go and get a typewriter that's going to last them a while, would you recommend manual or electric?
It's a matter of taste. Now, the electrics, they require less force, but they're also constantly humming, which I find kind of annoying. So personally, I do prefer a manual for most work.
And is there a brand that you like as a starter? Now, I'm not intending to start a collection. I just mean for actual usage of brainstorms and letters and that sort of thing. Are there better and worse brands that one can look for on eBay or wherever?
Yes. So if I had to mention just two, I would say Smith Corona portables in the US from especially the 1950s. Like their deluxe model was called the Silent Super, and it's got everything you need. Later on, there were still more bells and whistles, but they started to use more plastic and it's a little crappier. So that's kind of the sweet spot, the 50s, Smith Corona. There are lots of them out there. You can't go wrong. As for European typewriters, the consensus is the best one is Olympia. That was a West German make. They just use the, you know, really German precision and high quality materials. So again, the 50s are really good. The Olympia SM3 or SM4, or later on the SM9 is really great too.
And what do you think about going to eBay versus going to your local typewriter repair store to buy one?
Definitely the store. So I would do research on eBay it's really eye-opening and interesting to just put in typewriter and see what pops up and go through those listings. And you get a sense of the variety of looks and designs and the going rate for a used non-refurbished typewriter. And then, assuming you're lucky enough to have a local vendor, you'll find that, first of all, they're asking a lot more money, but that's fair because if they know what they're doing, they've fixed it up. There's a fresh ribbon. They guarantee it. And you get to try it. So the problem with buying it remotely is maybe it arrives in pieces, first of all. Maybe it arrives non-functional. Maybe it works, but you just don't like the feel of it. And then what are you going to do? Ship it back? So if you can find one in person, I really would recommend that. If you don't want to pay for a refurbished one, you could look on Craigslist or something and go see it in person, check it out.
Before we finish up, Richard, I want to bring up Heidegger because, as I said at the top of the interview, you're a philosophy professor at Xavier University. You've written multiple books on Heidegger. Heidegger is topical to Tectonic because he had a famous essay in 1954 called The Question Concerning Technology. Can you give a little overview about why Heidegger is important for people who are interested in technology's effects?
Sure. So Heidegger is famous for asking, what is the meaning of being? In other words, you know, what makes the difference between what we count as real and what we dismiss as unreal? He has a historical view on that. So it's a complicated story, but over thousands of years, kind of the dominant Western understanding of what it is to be has evolved in certain directions. And he thinks that now we have a technological understanding of being. So when he writes about technology, he's not so much concerned with this device or that device. And he's certainly not saying, you know, let's all go back to the Stone Age. But he's asking, well, how do we experience beings? How do we experience what exists in our modern technological world? And his basic answer is that we experience it as resources. So think of how often we use that word now, you know, without really reflecting on it. Natural resources, human resources, time resources, space resources. And what it means is that things are available for our exploitation. They can be converted into energy. They can serve human will. His problem with that is that it's impoverished, it's reductive, and it becomes all-encompassing, so that that's the only way we can think about things. I thought a great example of that on your show was on your Face Jail episode, right? The Apple Vision Pro, and you played this clip from this guy who's boasting about how he can watch 33 basketball games at the same time. And if I'm not getting enough dopamine here, I go over here and I get more dopamine. And it's crazy. It's like you're exploiting your experience as a set of dopamine resources. I mean, that's not rich human life. When it comes to digital electronic technology, Heidegger was getting pretty old by the time that came on the scene. But he did read Norbert Wiener's book, Cybernetics, which came in the late 40s. And he was, for those who don't know, a pioneering computer scientist who popularized the term digital versus analog, input and output, this kind of thing, and the whole cybernetics word. I think he invented that. So Heidegger was quite interested in this idea that for Wiener, cybernetics is not just about machines, right? It's about biological organisms too, about command and control and communication in the animal and the machine. So you can get a cyborg, a cybernetic organism. And ultimately, it becomes a whole worldview for Wiener and others. Everything's about information. Everything's about complexity of information and communication and control. And it becomes an example of a certain kind of technological approach to the world. And as for what are we going to do about this, Heidegger doesn't satisfy a lot of people. For one thing, he says you shouldn't try to do anything about it because the fix-it attitude is itself technological. It's more a question of relaxing, letting things be, putting things in context, looking for other alternatives. Also, earlier in his life, I'm sure you know, Heidegger had just the wrong response to modernity, which was to join the National Socialist Party.
Yes,
so
yes.
He did retreat from that, but a lot of people think he doesn't really have a solution, but he does have an interesting diagnosis of the problem. I should also add that he was not a fan of typewriters. He goes on a rant in one lecture course about how degraded it is to try to write on a typewriter because the essence of writing is handwriting. But in 2020 on eBay, I found a typewriter signed by Martin Heidegger. I snatched it up. And for various reasons, I think this is genuine. He scratched his signature into a sort of hidden place on the back of the typewriter. What is going on here? And I've published an article about this, but thanks to archival research that a friend of mine did, we know that in 1932, his assistant's typewriter was stolen. And he was quite upset because he would never write on a typewriter himself, but he needed somebody to translate his tiny little unintelligible handwriting into readable text. And so that's one thing his assistant did. And this typewriter I found was actually made in 1932. So I think it was the replacement for that stolen typewriter.
And do you still have it today?
Oh, yeah, it's a prized possession.
Wow. One last question, Richard. In addition to teaching and writing about Heidegger and being a leader in the typosphere, you also run something called the Harry Stephen Keeler Society, which I know our mutual friend Ed Park is also a part of. Harry Stephen Keeler was a novelist, sort of a cult favorite of fiction fans. Can you just tell us a little bit about Keeler and maybe if someone wanted to enter the Keelerverse, what book should they start with?
Yeah, he's a wonderful eccentric. It seems like he's a sort of literary modernist, except he's also trying to be entertaining and just a wonderfully weird guy. A favorite, and the first one that I read is called The Riddle of the Traveling Skull, and it was reissued by McSweeney's a few years ago.
All right, Richard, I feel like we could continue talking about these various interleaved topics. I really feel like you're a kindred spirit. I hope you'll keep in touch and come back on the show sometime. Again, the book is The Typewriter Revolution, A Typist's Companion for the 21st Century. Richard Polt, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Mark.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining 15 minutes of the show. And then I want you to stay tuned to WFMU because Dave Mandel is coming on with another great episode of It's Complicated. It's his prog rock show. Then Bad Animals with Jim the Poet and Amanda. And then Brother Daniel Blumen comes on with his eponymous show at 9 p.m. Eastern, taking us all the way to midnight. Just stay tuned is the message here. I also want to say thanks to Richard Polt again for spending time with me to talk about his book, The Typewriter Revolution. There are links to Richard's blog, which is also called Typewriter Revolution, on the playlist. So you've got the book site, the book, the blog. It's all Typewriter Revolution, basically. Go to WFMU.org and click playlist and comments. Or again, you can find the playlist in the future at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And there are other links as well. Richard sent me a link today, in fact, of a book written by August Dvorak, the inventor of the Dvorak key map. It's called Typewriting Behavior. And the book is hosted at the Internet Archive, and so you can read through that and pick up some more tips about typewriters and typewriting behavior. If you're interested in the Dvorak key map, by the way, I mentioned this on the playlist in the comments, but I ran a show, a Tectonic episode about the Dvorak key map back in December of 2019. It was the December 30th, 2019 episode, and actually that also featured a rare interview with DJ Paradox, if you're interested to hear from him 4.5 years ago. But there's also an image at the top of that playlist that you can view, and that comes from something called the Dvorak Zine, which I believe is still online at dvzine.org, and that tells the whole story about the Dvorak key map. It was written and drawn by cartoonists who are very passionate, as I am, about the Dvorak key map, and you can check it out. We did hear from one or two people on the playlist who said that they, I believe it was it Steve-O? I can't find it right now, but I think it was Steve-O who said that he also used the Dvorak key map and got rid of his wrist pain. And so, you know, this is not medical advice, but I can only share my own experience that I had pretty bad wrist pain typing on QWERTY keyboards. And when I switched to Dvorak, it just went away. So as for typewriters, I also mentioned this in the comments section, but I did take a look on eBay. I try not to visit these big tech sites that often, but on Richard's recommendation, I thought it was good. I went to eBay and I looked up Dvorak typewriter and nothing came up. I mean, they had other typewriters, but they're all the QWERTY keymap typewriters. So let me just put something out to you listeners. If you happen to be at a flea market or an estate sale or something, and you see a Dvorak, a Dvorak typewriter, okay, an actual manual typewriter with a Dvorak key map, email me or something. I mean, they're so rare. I would love to get one of those someday. My email is mark@wfmu.org. You can just email me from your surveillance device in the middle of the garage sale. I don't know. What else? We had some really, really good comments, and I don't have time to read all of them, but listener James from Westwood pointed out that Gramercy Typewriter is, in fact, still hanging on. They're at gramercytypewriter.com. That's a Manhattan-based typewriter repair shop. You should look around in your local community, wherever you live, and see if there's a typewriter repair shop. Because if you're interested, if you're really intrigued by what Richard was saying about typewriters, as he said, you know, usually you can get reliably good typewriters at the local repair shop. And then, of course, you're forming a relationship with the shop that you may want to go back to when you need a new ribbon or something, and you're supporting a local business. Murakami Wywolf says, stop shilling for big nib. With quills, all you need is a knife, oak gall, rust, lamp black, and a cooperative or slow duck, goose, or turkey. Okay, so yeah, so there's typewriters and then there's also quills. So perhaps we should next week go to an even more manual way of getting letters on the page. And I'm for it. Let me tell you, I'm for it, because this stuff, as we talked about with Richard, written matter on paper is going to outlast all of this cloud stuff, all of this surveillance data, all of these toxic big tech models. These are all temporary, friends. They are not going to rule over us forever. At some point, we're going to go back to a more sane way of organizing things, and I hope it will involve some digital technology as well, just not, you know, not from Google and Facebook and all the rest. And paper is still going to be in the mix somewhere. It's not the best at everything, but it's the best at some things. And I'm so glad that Richard was here to give us a little tour. Let me just I want to read you this typewriter manifesto. I mentioned it a couple of times in the interview with Richard. This is the original manifesto, one page that he wrote, and it's included in his book, The Typewriter Revolution. Here's what he wrote. The Typewriter Manifesto. We assert our right to resist the paradigm, to rebel against the information regime, to escape the data stream. We strike a blow for self-reliance, privacy, and coherence against dependency, surveillance, and disintegration. We affirm the written word and written thought against multimedia, multitasking, and the meme. We choose the real over representation, the physical over the digital, the durable over the unsustainable, the self-sufficient over the efficient. The revolution will be typewritten. And again, that was the Typewriter Manifesto by Richard Polt. Thank you, Richard, for bringing that into the world, and thanks for bringing your wisdom. And as one of the commenters said, maybe the best explanation of Heidegger we've ever heard over the airwaves here at WFMU. It was a fun interview and I think a really important topic to remind us that there are other technologies out there that are not trying to burn down the entire world and that actually do useful things and do not arrogate themselves to say we are the be-all, end-all of all technology. No, typewriters say, you know what? We're not the best at everything. We're the best at this and that and maybe this other thing. And try it. And if you don't like it, go back to quills. That's fine too, as opposed to big tech, which is trying to invade and seep into every area of our lives, just exploiting us at every turn. People who are trying to help, who are helping. Speaking of people who are helping, we want to say thank you to the volunteers who came to the station today. We're getting the fundraising marathon swag out, and so we want to say thanks to Emily, Elisa, John, and Neil. And if you're waiting on your swag, it's coming, it's coming. It may take a little while, but don't worry. I saw it. The stuff is getting packed up, and hopefully you'll get yours soon. So thanks to those volunteers. I wanted to do something a little bit unusual at the end here. This is a complete non sequitur. We've been hearing a lot about AI-generated music recently, and I may need to do another episode on this because I did do an episode on AI-generated music a couple of years ago. You can find it in the archives. But there's been this new spate of music and songs that are making the rounds. And our good friend Web Hamster Henry did something interesting. He used one of the AI-generating music engines to create a new song that includes my sign-off, you know, the forget Facebook, avoid Apple, and all of that. So I'm going to play that for you now. This is going to be your homework for next week, and we're going to hear it from this AI engine, and I'll have another word to say about that in a second. But here is something, thanks to Web Hamster Henry, for you to enjoy. It's just under a minute. Here it is.
Avoid Apple. Abandon Amazon. Forget Facebook. Trash TikTok. And for God's sake, get off Google!
Okay, get off Google. Whatever you do, get off Google. That is your homework for the next week. And I don't intend to be sending out a lot of AI music here on this show. I don't want to normalize it or celebrate it too much. But, you know, it's a novelty right now. Everyone's trying it out. It's kind of fun. So a song here or two, I think, is pretty harmless. So we can get a sense of what this technology can do. So thanks to Web Hamster Henry for giving us a little taste and a new way to use the tools of big tech to tell us to get off of big tech, which I know is eventually not a winning strategy, but it was kind of fun to try out tonight. You have been listening, friends, to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. And gosh, I don't need to do the sign-off because we just heard it. I want you to stay tuned for It's Complicated with the host that you can't handle, Dave Mandel. And then stay tuned and be in touch. And for our outro this evening, I thought, who better to take us out than the Boston Typewriter Orchestra? This is a group of musicians who play nothing but manual typewriters. And so this is something they recorded live back in 2023, and I thought this would be well worth listening to. Here it is, a song called Left Blank. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time.
sends this page intentionally left blank.
And greetings, everyone. Welcome to another thrilling installment of It's Complicated. It's Complicated. With a lozenge in my mouth, forgive me. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here hosting this show every Monday evening at 7 p.m., following hot on the heels of Mark Hurst and the Tectonic program. Thrilled to play music for you again this week. And we're going to start tonight's show with, appropriately, a track from a group called Elephant Nine. Why is it appropriate? Because I said so. No, Elephant Nine is a group. I was toying with the idea of saying this is Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and see if anyone caught me in the lie. But I won't do that to you. But this group, I'm not going to insult them by saying they're a knockoff of Emerson, Lake, and Palmer or anything like that. Really great group. And as far as I'm concerned, they kind of capture the spirit of early Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. I don't listen to early Emerson, Lake, and Palmer that often. Don't tell anybody. But listening to this, you know, preparing for the show this afternoon, and I thought, I had visions of the first Emerson, Lake, and Palmer album. It's really, a great tribute. It's a really great group. They are from Norway, Elephant Nine, and we're going to hear the title track from an album called Dodo Voodoo. Really incredible, with a very ELP-like Hammond organ and a drummer who obviously has been listening, I would say, to Carl Palmer. Enough of that. This is Elephant Nine.
We'll be right back.
So great. That's the group Elephant Nine. They are, again, from Norway. I heard the title track from an album called Dodo Voodoo, and it's from a the title track from an album released in 2008 from Elephant Nine. That is great. So good. We're going to move on. Now, I sort of teased last week and mentioned that I had gotten as a birthday gift a couple weeks ago a massive guide to Italian prog rock, and I freely admit there's just so many groups. I freely admit there's a lot of stuff I didn't know, a lot of stuff I did, but a lot of stuff I didn't, and I've been working my way through it. And we don't want the show to be completely dominated by Italian prog, do we? Now, but I'm gonna sort of drop more and more of the stuff that I've only recently discovered or things that I just forgotten about, whatever, into my show in the coming weeks. So I'm going to play a couple of Italian tracks now. First is going to be from a group called Cervello, or Cervello, I guess, C-E-R-V.